Welcome, everyone, to the Battle of Gettysburg podcast. I am your co-host, licensed battlefield guide Eric Lindblade, and as always, I am joined by my co-host, licensed battlefield guide Jim Hessler. So, Jim, we are back. What's our topic tonight?
We are doing part two on the life and times of historian, official government historian, John Badger Batchelder. Now, in part one, we talked about Batchelder's life, his commercial ventures, and his influence here on the early history of the Battle of Gettysburg and Gettysburg National Military Park. But on part two of this special two-part event, we're going to deep dive more into some of the controversies that Batchelder got involved with some of the veterans, talk specifically about some of his more lasting influences. We're going to talk about kind of the legacy and the rediscovery of John Batchelder. And last but not least, we are going to talk about the Batchelder Papers, which were recently reprinted, long out of print. They've been reprinted by publisher Savis Beatty. Eric and I are going to share our thoughts on how to use the Batchelder Papers. So I think we got a wide range of Badger, Batchelder to cover tonight, and can't wait to get into part two and see what we come up with.
And if that's not enough, you probably noticed in episode one, we were kind of light on listener questions.
Yes.
This episode that we asked about, you know, the two Batchelder episodes, generated, I believe, our most listener questions we've ever had. So we incorporated a lot of those into the life of Batchelder. All the ones that we did not cover, we are going to be putting into this one as well. So if you ask your question, you're thinking, wait a minute,
where's my question?
We got you. Don't worry. As we say, your questions help drive the show. Sometimes, even if we don't answer them directly, the reason we talk about things in the show is because you asked about it.
Absolutely.
So with that, before we get into the episode, Jim, tell everyone tonight about our show's sponsor.
Yeah, so once again, we are coming to you from the new home of the Battle of Gettysburg podcast, Getty's Gear. Now, Getty's Gear is located in the old Gettysburg Village at 777 Baltimore Street, across from the Tour Center, and their philosophy is simple. They want to produce high-quality products at reasonable prices with exceptional customer service. So you can find a wide array of unique and interesting items that are made right here in Gettysburg. We're talking cigars, we're talking pottery, we're talking Gettysburg coffee, home decor, dog treats, gift for the special man or lady in your life. It's all here at Getty's Gear. Do some holiday shopping there. Support a small business. Guys, Amazon doesn't need any more of your money. Give some of that holiday money to Getty's Gear. Again, and they're located right here on Cemetery Hill. It's on good ground. Very good ground. Getty's Gear.
And folks, they have been tremendous to us. They have really stepped up during this very challenging time for us to give us recording space. They have been overly supportive, so support the folks that support the show. That's the best thing we can ask. Show them you appreciate the efforts that they've shown towards us and helps them out. They're really wonderful folks here. You will not be disappointed. Now, people have asked me, why are you guys doing a disclaimer now?
Wait a minute. Did people actually ask?
Yes, I've actually had people ask, why are you doing a disclaimer now?
Our listeners are sharp. Nothing gets by them.
And I have to say, you know you made it when you got to put on a disclaimer. The reason we're doing this is, simply put, Jim and I are speaking for ourselves. We are not speaking as guides. We are not speaking for any organization that we might be a part of. We are speaking as individuals, as historians who just happen to be guides, in case there's any confusion on that. We are speaking for ourselves. So, of course, things change. You get a little more attention on things. We just want to make sure that we're on the up and up here, that we're following all the rules and regulations that there could be.
We are Gettysburg historians like John Batchelder, no more, no less.
Imagine if Batchelder had a podcast.
Well, you know, it's funny, when we were doing the prep, I thought of that and I forgot to use that joke in episode one, because the guy did guidebooks, the guy did maps, the guy did artwork, he went around the country speaking. If John Batchelder were alive today, I'm thinking you're getting John Batchelder's Battle of Gettysburg podcast.
Do we think Batchelder could have passed the guide exam?
No, I don't think so. Because, you know, we got stuff in there today about the Department of the Interior and the Wilmot Proviso. And, you know, Batchelder was really a Gettysburg guy. I'm thinking he is not passing today's guide exam.
You know, I think what he does, he knocks it out of the park on the Gettysburg section.
Exactly.
And he fails miserably on the written section.
But think, though, if he makes it to the oral exam process, think how awesome that would be. Imagine his proctors telling him he's got it wrong, and he's like, what do you mean I got it wrong? I'm John Batchelder. This is where this regiment was. That would just be awesome to watch.
It would be, actually. Yeah. So,
would he have to trim the long, flowing beard to become a guide? Like, do we have regulations around that?
I don't think for the New York Yankees, we don't have restrictions against facial hair. So,
yeah, but he couldn't wear cargo pants. So
he could not wear cargo pants.
If John Batchelder was into cargo pants, he could not wear those.
You know, I would have to think he would be, because you know what? I'm going to admit it. I break the rules.
I love my cargo pants.
I love my cargo pants on tours, because you know what? I've got a lot of stuff to carry.
I know.
I've got a mask to carry. I've got keys to carry. In years past, other people's keys to carry. And also other things you need on a tour. So, yeah, you know, it's funny. Other people that work here can wear cargo pants.
Oh.
But we can't. I'll just leave it at that. Hence the disclaimer, folks.
Hence the disclaimer. And the only bit of housekeeping that I want to remind folks on from episode one, again, Eric has issued a challenge. If you guys can push the podcast into the top 50, did we say top 50 history or top 50 overall? I forget.
Top 50 history.
Okay. All right. See, folks, Eric's waffling a little bit here.
Actually, no, it's easier to get us top 50 of history than it is top 50 overall.
Is that right?
I mean, we've got to compete against true crime podcasts.
I know. Okay.
We've got to compete against pro wrestling podcasts.
All right. So top 50 history podcast, Eric will shave his beard like John Batchelder. And if you don't know what John Batchelder's beard looks like, Google it and you'll see what I'm talking about.
Or if you want to see what John Batchelder looks like, find us on social media. You can find us on Facebook at the Battle of Gettysburg Podcast, on Twitter at Gettysburg Pod, on Instagram at the Battle of Gettysburg Podcast, or you can email us at gettysburgpodcast@gmail.com and we will email you a picture of John Batchelder. Follow us on social media. Interact with us. We really enjoy that. Also, we always harp on it, and I'm going to keep doing it, because if you want to see me get the Batchelder beard, you got to review the show. The reviews help push us up through there. Many of you have been really kind enough to take your time to write some really wonderful words. We certainly appreciate it all. So if you've not done so, please write us a review on the podcast platform of your choice. It really helps us out significantly.
No doubt. And my own disclaimer, though, don't feel if you are not on social media, we'd love to have you, but don't feel like we are married to social media. We feel each episode of the podcast is a self-contained episode and, you know, that you can listen to it without referring to Facebook and that sort of thing. So I just wanted to clear up that own disclaimer, too.
And also, frankly, between working full time as a guide, working on book and research projects, recording the show, editing the show, helping to run our social media. The last thing I want to do is also be webmaster for the Battle of Gettysburg podcast website. Well, it's, you know, there's only so many hours in my day, and I like to sleep.
Well, whatever happened, though, to superfan Michael Reinhardt? I thought he was our social media director.
You know what? He's doing a tremendous job for us on Twitter still. I'm handling mostly Instagram, and we both do Facebook.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've kind of split it up a little bit, which certainly Superfan Mike has been a tremendous help. You know, it takes a lot off my plate sometimes. So.
But I do a lot on Facebook too, folks. I don't want to not get any credit for this.
No.
I handle my share of Facebook.
Well, I'll say this. If you talk to us on Facebook, you're talking to both of us.
Absolutely.
So there you go.
All right.
All right. So with that said, let's get into part two, because there's a lot to unpack here with really the, I'm going to call them challenges and controversies of John Batchelder.
I like it. The first controversy that comes to mind with me dates into the spring of 1864. And you still sometimes see this referred to in various Gettysburg books, the question of whether or not John Batchelder was historicus. Now, for a little bit of background here, Historicus was an anonymous observer who was attached somehow to the Union Army Third Corps at Gettysburg and was, in fact, after the Battle of Gettysburg, shall we say Historicus was rather supportive of the version of history perpetuated by our own Dan Sickles.
Wait a minute. People are unsupportive of Sickles' version of history?
Even today, hard to believe, yeah. Yeah. Man. So we're kind of doubling down now here with our own Dan Sickles report and kind of talking about this. But yeah, so Historicus was an anonymous observer who posted some stuff in the newspapers during the Joint Committee testimony in 1864 that was favorable to Sickles, unfavorable to General Meade, unfavorable to some of the 5th Corps troops who were supposed to be supporting the 3rd Corps, and basically just has a reputation in Gettysburg circles today. You know, when you say Historicus, people kind of laugh, you know, they know the reference, but just for any background there for anybody who didn't know who Historicus was. So with that, let me just sort of tell you how John Batchelder fits into this. What seems to have happened in 1925, so long after all the participants involved are dead, Robert Carter told a historian, W.A. Graham, that Sickles probably would have been tried for disobedience, quote, had he not lost a leg. But John Batchelder, a loudmouthed, blatant photographer and henchman of Sickles, made the people believe by an avalanche of propaganda that Sickles held back Longstreet, and all writers began to believe it and praised Sickles' act. Okay, now if you're really deep into the Gettysburg history, you're like, well, who cares what Robert Carter and W.A. Graham thought? Here's the problem. We always talk about on the show, you got to check your sources, because using Carter as his source, Meade biographer Freeman Cleaves labeled Batchelder as Historicus in his widely reprinted biography, Meade of Gettysburg. To date, you know, you don't have a lot of Meade at Gettysburg biographies on your shelf. I know there's a bunch of them coming out in the next year or so, but Meade of Gettysburg is probably something that many Gettysburg students have read or are familiar with, and right then and there, Cleaves says John Batchelder was Historicus. So, you know, again, if you haven't checked your source, that's a name that Batchelder often gets tied to.
You know, we talked about last episode all the cool titles that Batchelder had. Superintendent of Tablets and Legends, official government historian, and you know what? I'm going to say coolest of all, Sickles henchman.
Sickles henchman, yeah.
I mean, the only thing cooler than he called him a horseman.
Could though we be described as Sickles henchman, possibly?
Yeah, I'm sure we've been described as worse.
Yeah, well, I'm sure we have, right? And this is where at least one person out there is, you know, like Superfan Paul is throwing up his hands and saying, oh, the tiresome Dan Sickles, here they go again. Should we go on, though?
Yeah, but you know what? I'll placate him. Strong Vincent was a hero, and the 83rd Pennsylvania was wonderful.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, okay, so the question now comes down to, was John Batchelder Historicus? No. Now, I can't say that definitively, but talked about this in my Sickles at Gettysburg book, on sale everywhere, wink, wink. Maybe at Getty's gear. Maybe we should get him to start selling my books.
I think we could probably work that out.
We'll probably do that. But anyways, I digress. By the way, where was I? Oh, yeah, so we talked about this. So here's the thing. First of all, we touched on this in the last episode. Batchelder's studies, and especially during this 1863-1864 era, really depended on getting permission from Union Army Commanding General George Meade to stay attached to the Army of the Potomac and to continue your research. So think about this. Would it make sense for John Batchelder to be courting George Meade's permission on the one hand, but then being basically Sickles' henchman throwing anti-Meade stuff to the newspapers on the other hand? You know, I've known a few artists in my day who can be a little squirrely, but in this case, I think not.
Yeah, and I think also, if we just look at the timeline, the amount of effort that Historicus takes, Batchelder's doing a lot of stuff. I mean, yep. He's researching the battle, he's putting together the isometric map, he's interviewing officers, he's traveling, so it's hard to pin that down. Now, where probably Cleaves looks at this a little bit is that, yes, Meade signs off on the map, But I think Meade somewhat thought of Batchelder at times a bit of a nuisance.
Uh-huh.
And we know Meade's personality. Meade never cultivated the media very well. Outsiders do not do well with George Meade. Batchelder trying to gather information about past battles, and Meade's thinking, you know, I've got enough to worry about with the current battles and future battles. So maybe he does view Batchelder a little bit as a, you know, and even Batchelder himself says that, you know, Meade considered me a crank.
Yeah.
So that's Batchelder's word. So, yeah, that could lead you to think that maybe Batchelder would be willing to, you know, drive the hatchet into Meade's back. But, you know, I just don't think he's going to play that role because that's just – there's too much to lose if it finds out that he is Historicus.
Exactly. And you know, by the way, this gets me thinking, you know, we put the snapping turtle and the badger against each other in the ring. Like, again, just another epic cage match.
Actually, you know, maybe even a strap match.
Loser leave town, loser leave the army camp kind of thing.
Loser leaves Army of Potomac camp.
Yeah. Okay, so all joking aside, what we think today probably happened was Carter might have mistaken our John Batchelder for a staff officer by the name of Lieutenant Colonel R.N. Batchelder. So again, might have been a case of mistaken identity. Again, how many Batchelders are you going to run into? I guess it would be kind of a common mistake on Carter's part. But it does then bring up the part of, you know, what was the Batchelder-Sickles relationship? Because I know we had a couple listener questions.
We had one question asking, you know, did they ever really meet each other? And also, what was their relationship like?
Yeah. And in the 1890s, you know, when John Batchelder and Dan Sickles were both active in the early memorialization of Gettysburg, Batchelder, in fact, in a couple instances during that period, made it quite clear that he did not support attacks on Meade's reputation. And there's one bit of 1890 correspondence where Batchelder told John Nicholson that Dan Butterfield, quote, knows that I despise his attempt to injure the reputation of General Meade, and basically goes on to refer to the scandalous attack on General Meade that was made in the papers by Historicus, about which I do not hesitate to give my opinion. General Butterfield knows that I do not sympathize with those who have tried so hard to injure the reputation of the dead commander-in-chief. So not only was Batchelder not Historicus, he was actually quite favorable to General Meade.
And I think what we also see with Batchelder is I've never really found a lot of hard evidence where he's coming down tremendously hard on Sickles either. You know, if you look at some of his writings, they tend to stick with the ORs. He doesn't put much analysis in. So I think he, you know, one thing we'll say about Batchelder is, yes, at times people will accuse him of having favorites and those that he doesn't like fall out of favor. But I think, you know, it's kind of weird in a controversy that is really marked by either your team Meade or your team Sickles, Batchelder kind of stays in the middle.
He does, and you're right. But, you know, what I always say, too, remember, Meade dies in the 1870s, as you know, as we well know. Sickles is around until the early 20th century. And, folks, make no mistake about it, whatever you think of Dan Sickles, during the memorialization era at Gettysburg National Military Park, Sickles himself was a powerful and influential figure that you did not want to run across. For example, in 1891, when Batchelder was trying to enlist the New York legislature's help in honoring George Greene's brigade, Batchelder was reminded by a veteran, quote, "With General Sickles against your bill, it would likely fail." And, quote, "If Sickles does not fight it, it will go through." So, yeah, I think Batchelder and, you know, they also served together on the GBMA, accompanied each other on visits to the battlefield many, many times. We have photographic evidence, you know, where the two of them are in the same photo. So there's no doubt that they crossed paths many times during this era. And even when the New York State Monument Commission, which was led by Dan Sickles, wanted to erect a very, very prominent memorial on Cemetery Hill, which would overshadow basically everything else on the field, Batchelder fought that. And he fought that because he didn't want basically Sickles and his New York buddies dominating the battlefield. So yeah, kind of an interesting story again to think about Sickles and Batchelder butting heads, having to work together, you know, traveling, hanging out together during those early days of Gettysburg National Military Park.
And you would think personality-wise, Batchelder and Sickles, you'd think this is combustible.
Right.
You know, my mother often says about me, I'm often wrong, but never in doubt. So that you can kind of say the same thing about those two guys. But I think what you see is that there is some cooperation. I think there appears to be some mutual respect between the two individuals. And I think we see actually a good bit of fairness there. I mean, and understanding that, you know, yes, the Cemetery Hill monument aside, mm-hmm. you know, I think Sickles End of the Day could probably understand the reasoning on that. Rather than just, you know, this guy hates me, I hate him, let's bury him in the newspapers.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, New York's monument in the National Cemetery is one of the biggest and most impressive things on that part of the battlefield. Again, you know, it's part of the cemetery that maybe the average visitor to Gettysburg doesn't see or walk through. There's a lot of trees around there today to kind of, you know, kind of cover it, so to speak. But ultimately, New York and Sickles did kind of get what they wanted too. Yeah, I see two just stubborn, you know, again, one is New York, one is New England. It's like getting a Yankee and a Red Sox fan
That's
together.
That's a natural rivalry.
Kind of thing. Yeah, sort of thing. So, but we did get some questions about Batchelder and Sickles, so hopefully we kind of addressed that.
So let's now move on to another well-known moment in Batchelder's life or association, and some would even say another controversial moment in terms of his interpretation of the Battle of Gettysburg.
Yeah, and that would be Batchelder's designation as the area around the copse of trees and the angle as being the high watermark. You know, and again, as folks know, Pickett's Charge is another topic that I've written about. It's a topic of, you know, interest to Eric and I, and hopefully anybody who's interested in the Battle of Gettysburg. But I could argue that Batchelder's single most lasting contribution to the history would be popularizing the copse of trees and the high watermark as the turning points of the battle. So the story actually starts in about 1868. Now, remember in part one, when we were talking about Batchelder's various commercial ventures, and I mentioned the 1870 Walker painting of the repulse of Longstreet's assault? Well, in 1868, while they were kind of lounging around the art studio, kind of working on this thing, according to Batchelder, Longstreet was in Walker's studio examining the work, quote unquote, with a sad smile. And Longstreet said, "There's where I came to grief." To which Batchelder replied, "Yes, I have called your assault the tidal wave, and the copse of trees in the center of the picture the high watermark of the rebellion." And Longstreet seemingly agreed, saying, "We were successful until then. From that point, we retreated and continued to recede and never again made successful headway." Now, before we go on with the battlefield, I just kind of want to touch on Longstreet here a little bit. So to me, this meeting in Walker's studio, to me, implies that by 1868, Batchelder was already fixated on the idea of the copse of trees as the high watermark, and that Longstreet apparently agreed with him, although we should mention that Longstreet neglects to give any special importance to the copse of trees, really, in any of his major post-war articles. In Annals of the War, Longstreet references Cemetery Hill as the target. In Battles and Leaders, the Southerners were going to renew the attack against Cemetery Hill, and in his later memoir, he basically doesn't specify the target, although he calls Pickett the division of direction. So all I'm pointing out there before we go on with this, you got Batchelder saying by the late 1860s, Longstreet agreed with the idea. You don't really have Longstreet corroborating it in the stuff that he publishes. Kind of interesting in my mind.
Adding to all of this, Batchelder's already come to view Gettysburg as the decisive battle of the war. But a decisive battle needs a decisive moment.
Right, right.
And if we would get 50 of our colleagues in this room and we said, "What's the decisive moment at the Battle of Gettysburg?" we're getting a number of different answers.
Yeah.
Somebody's got to come in and say, "All right, what's the decisive moment? What's the decisive place?" And Batchelder starts to, I really think, formulate this idea. And also, we should mention, Batchelder's one of the ones that really popularizes the term high tide with Gettysburg.
Yeah.
Well, think about the analogy to your tidal wave. Where does that wave stop? It stops at Cemetery Ridge. It stops at the angle. It stops with the copse of trees. Mm-hmm. And even the word copse, how many people use the word copse every day? It's a clump of trees.
Exactly.
It's a bunch of trees. Copse is a very unique word that Batchelder uses to further signify this is an important place. It's not the clump of trees.
I always say on my battlefield tours, by studying the Battle of Gettysburg, you become the only people in the country who still use the term salient and copse on a regular basis.
And maybe even cupola.
And cupola. You could add that as well. Exactly right. So the story goes on. So kind of embellishing then upon his 1868 conversation with Longstreet, Batchelder later elaborated on his growing fondness for this thicket or copse of trees. And according to Batchelder, soon after the close of the war, he spent a day touring the battlefield with Pickett's staff officer, Walter Harrison. Now, before I go on, people, not Harrison the actor, Harrison from Pickett's staff. And if you're thinking, well, who cares? Harrison on Pickett's staff wrote a little history afterwards about Pickett's division at Gettysburg and elsewhere.
A minor work.
Exactly. A minor work. Exactly. So we're not talking about Harrison the actor. But Staff Officer Harrison basically then spent several hours under the shade cast by these trees, and according to Batchelder, Harrison explained to Batchelder what an important figure the trees were at the time of the battle and how it had been a landmark towards which Longstreet's assault had been directed. Batchelder was so impressed, so he said, by this conversation that Batchelder declared, quote, "This copse of trees must have been the high watermark of the rebellion," to which Harrison agreed. And from that point on, Batchelder, quote unquote, felt a reverence for those trees. Now, before we go on, I'll just mention Harrison in his 1870 memoirs seems to date this visit as occurring in August of 1869, and although he says he did gain a lot of valuable information from being on the ground in Gettysburg, he doesn't really indicate that, you know, this Batchelder conversation happened. So again, I'm just kind of throwing that out there.
And we have another example of Batchelder's reverence, and I don't know if this is apocryphal or not, but those trees, the copse, were owned after the battle by Basil Biggs. They're on his property. So what we see is there's a moment where Biggs is out there chopping down parts of the copse of trees to make fence rails or firewood or whatever else he needs. Yep. And Batchelder comes over and says, "Stop, stop, what are you doing? And, you know, do you understand how important this is?" And he almost makes the argument that they will be much more valuable if you leave them. You'll make much more money than on fence rails. And, you know, I don't know how much Basil Biggs ever got of that on the copse of trees, walking sticks and commemorative pin blocks and everything else. But it's another example that adds to this. And I don't know if it happened. It's a great story.
It's another guide story.
It does fit into this idea that Batchelder is starting to have a reverence for this spot. And I think what it's showing is that he's not only deeming the copse of trees as the important location on July 3rd in terms of the aiming of the attack, he's also designated maybe the most important spot on the battlefield.
Exactly.
And of course, Batchelder's really lasting monument. And we actually had someone make a note, you know, or a comment on our social media that said, you know, why doesn't Batchelder have a monument here? He does.
He kind of does.
He kind of does. And I would argue it's the high watermark memorial that he has right there.
Yeah.
The book of history, if you will.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, that's Batchelder's own monument that he wanted there. So of anything on the battlefield that Batchelder wanted memorialized, that was it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, to kind of add to that, the Biggs conversation supposedly happened in the fall of 1869. So you see 1868, 1869, 1870. This is kind of all coming together. Batchelder continues the theme in his 1873 guidebook, which we touched on in the last episode. He referred visitors to a peculiar umbrella-shaped copse of trees, which cut boldly against the sky, formed a prominent landmark, which was selected by General Longstreet to guide the direction of the column in its charge. And I'm not going to go into all the additional examples of that, but what you see when you read a lot of the monument dedications then around the high watermark area, you know, in the 1880s or that, you see that theme almost repeated verbatim. These trees were a clean outline against the sky. They were a salt assaulted by the flower of the rebel host. You know, this stone wall gave it its prominence and things like that that really kind of build this up. Such that so then the site itself was finally acquired by the GBMA in 1881 to 1882. And in order to protect the woods from relic hunters, Batchelder obtained the GBMA agreement in 1887 to surround the trees with a fence. So that's where that's why we have a fence around, which again, a lot of people ask on tours, why is there a fence around those trees? John Batchelder, 1887, got permission to do that. And at about the same time, the association requested that Batchelder submit a design for a tablet descriptive of the engagement and movements of all of the commands engaged in the July 3rd assault.
And what we see too, if you just look at the viewscape around the high watermark today, it's the location of the heaviest monumentation anywhere on the battlefield.
Yeah, yeah.
There's markers everywhere. So what we see is this idea is not just being proposed by Batchelder, but it's also being accepted by the veterans, because how many secondary markers do we see there? You know, we can't have our main marker here, but you know what? We're going to put a secondary marker to show people we're here.
Yeah.
We were in this vicinity, and you can't discount the impact that it has. He not only designated a key point of the field to be the point, but he also led to the overwhelming abundance of monuments there in large part because of what he said.
Yeah, well, I mean, what I always, and you're right, and what I always say on my tours and in my books, you know, Batchelder's vision of Pickett's Charge won. Hell, I'm calling it Pickett's Charge. Batchelder's version of the July 3rd assault is what history won. You know, the ground over which Pickett marched towards the high water mark, heavily preserved, heavily commemorated. How about the ground over which Pettigrew and Trimble marched? Not so well, right? By the early 20th century, and you had Colt Park and Camp Cold and all this other stuff going in. You know, to this day, Pettigrew and Trimble, still a sideshow. You want to interpret Pickett's Charge, you take him to the angle, you take him to the high water mark, you show him the trees, you bring in Pickett's division. Batchelder's interpretation is what, you know, most people still get today.
And also the most famous visual depiction of Pickett's Charge, the cyclorama.
Yeah.
What's the focal point of the cyclorama?
Absolutely.
It's there. I mean, so it, even if it's not directly influenced, it's influenced nonetheless.
Well, I think, you know, and I always say too, you're right, you know, and then you have Batchelder and the cyclorama playing off each other. One makes the other more popular, the other makes the other one more popular, and now you have kind of this almost multimedia approach, you know, in the late 19th century doing exactly that, making Pickett's Charge the focal point. Let me just wrap up with the High Watermark Memorial and then some more thoughts on this. So ultimately, you know, Batchelder gets the agreement in 1887 to, you know, kind of submit a design for that. There's some indication that the GBMA thought he was just going to put a little plaque on the fence kind of thing. But our man, John Badger Batchelder, has other ideas. And so finally in 1892, nearly 24 years after that original conversation with Longstreet in the art studio, was the High Watermark Memorial dedicated. And Eric, I think you already touched on it, but is the High Watermark Memorial not an impressive monument?
It is, and it's one that we get asked a lot about. What's the deal with that big book? What's the deal with the bronze cannon? It
the
draws
trees,
attention.
The
yeah.
Fence. Yeah.
You know, and yeah. Now I think before we move away from this, you know, often we call what's quote unquote Pickett's Charge also Longstreet's assault.
Mm-hmm.
At times Batchelder even uses that term. We did have a listener that has, well, she's in a bit of a rough patch right now. She cannot decide. This is super fan Jackie. She cannot decide who had better sideburns post-war, Batchelder or Longstreet?
Ooh.
So, you know, let's help out our listeners here. Let's try to give some insight and some wisdom to maybe help them make the right choice.
So, great question, Superfan Jackie. First of all, I would say, you know, when you look at these images of the battlefield reunions, one-legged Dan Sickles, you know, white-whiskered Longstreet, white-whiskered John Batchelder, the first thing is this is kind of a serious issue because you got to look closely at the photo to know if you're looking at Longstreet and Batchelder. You know, I'm inclined to say Batchelder did it better because I think during this era, he was a little more, well, he was more financially successful than Longstreet was. So I think just Batchelder does the styling and profiling a little bit better. But knowing how wedded our super fans are to the movie, I'm going to go with the popular vote and say, damn it, Longstreet looked better.
You know, because I've thrown down the gauntlet on the Batchelder challenge, if you get us top 50, I'll grow the Batchelder facial hair. I got to go Batchelder on this one.
All right.
Now, we also had some follow-up questions, you know, on Batchelder. Who was his barber? How did he tend to his mustache and beard? Superfan Maria asked us on Twitter, how did he keep that stylish facial hair? And, you know, and these are kind of funny questions, and we'll answer them anyway, but you know, Batchelder, in some respects, is probably known more for his facial hair.
Than
what he actually did on the battlefield. He's the guy with the beard. And I think what's funny, too, is that both Longstreet and Batchelder, you sometimes see people put photos up on social media. Look, it's James Longstreet in the battlefield. No, it's not.
I know.
It's John Batchelder.
And vice versa. And
So I think it is one there. You know, I will just say I do not know his personal grooming that he did. He did not leave us any. There is no quote in the Batchelder papers about how he does this.
Volume 6 of the Batchelder
papers. Yeah, you know, grooming of like facial hair by John Batchelder. Yeah. I'm just going to assume that he uses the same meticulous care of the grooming of his facial hair that he did in compiling the history of the battle gauge.
Okay.
I'm going to just put it right there, I think.
I'm going to throw Mrs. Batchelder a bone and hope she had something to do with it. You know, I know there's the one image of the two of them, and she's sitting on a rock, and somebody said she wasn't smiling or she didn't look happy or something like that. Well, I'm going to give Mrs. Batchelder a little shout-out here today, because think about how, you know, she would have had to put up with all of his Gettysburg road trips. Oh, honey, can't we go to the Cape on vacation? No, we got to go to Gettysburg again. And again, man or woman, I'm thinking that's something that, you know, many folks who are in Gettysburg one-sided relationships where one of you are into going to Gettysburg and the other one isn't, surely you can relate to what Mrs. Batchelder must have gone through.
And clearly we can both relate to this because I'm sure you have given tours where you have that dynamic where one spouse loves the battle, the other one's along for the ride. And folks, it's not a man or a woman thing. I've had it either way on that.
Being sexist.
Yeah, but it's always an interesting dynamic, and it makes for actually a challenging tour at times.
Yeah.
When you got somebody really fired up and the other's like, you said this is a two-hour tour, right? You know, hey, Mrs. Batchelder, by all accounts, seemed very supportive of what he's doing. Now, of course, we don't know that, but you know, you have to think he would not be as gung-ho about this. If she wasn't.
Without the support of a good spouse in the background.
Yeah, you know, it's one thing to be really fired up about, so it's another thing to, you know, the rough patch at home.
And, you know, if he was getting a lot of these $50,000 paychecks from the government, the Battle of Gettysburg was still putting some bread on the Batchelder table.
And you know, we did have a question about Batchelder's family, you know, and whether or not did this make them rich, and, you know, I don't know if Batchelder set out necessarily to get rich about this, but it's very clear that this was somewhat career-driven. Batchelder and his wife certainly benefited from the money raised from all of his ventures. They also did have a daughter who passed away in 1874. We didn't mention that, I think, in the first episode.
She died at the age of 13.
Yeah,
so, you know, it's obviously a sad
sort of
thing.
A sad story there for the Batchelders. But, and, you know, we've sometimes seen when people have personal tragedy, they throw themselves into the work more.
Right.
You know, not trying to play armchair psychologist here, but the loss of a child is a devastating moment.
No doubt.
And, you know, maybe this is something else that further drives him when maybe he might have moved on to something else.
Right.
Just stick with it.
No, and I think those are all good points. Hey, real quick, though, since you brought up the daughter, Charlotte, sometimes in these Batchelder stories, you see Charlotte is their only child. However, in Batchelder Papers, version 3, page 1998, there's a letter from Batchelder to what would appear to be his son, Charles. So I'm not really, you know, like we said, there isn't a lot of good biographical deep dive on the Batchelders out there. So maybe somebody wants to kind of take that ball and run with it and figure out ultimately, you know, what were their two kids or anybody else. But,
you know, if I'm going to grow the Batchelder facial hair, should I write a Batchelder biography?
I think somebody should, yeah. And, you know, if you're going as far as growing the hair, I think somebody should.
Well, you know, I mean, at one point it was Nature Boy Buddy Rogers, then it's Nature Boy Ric Flair. Well, you know what? Maybe I'll be
Nature Boy.
Nature Boy Eric Lindblay. Just, you know, following the footsteps of Nature Boy John Batchelder.
Eric Badger Lindblade.
Works for me.
Oh, hey, before we move on, though, from the high watermark, you mentioned this before about getting colleagues and, you know, we would probably get 50 different answers. I just thought I would do this for fun. Yes or no, July 3rd assault, is it, in your opinion, the turning point of the Battle of Gettysburg?
No.
Okay. I will say yes, because as it was explained to me once 20 years ago by the great Wayne Motz, Robert E. Lee has the ability to wage war up until the afternoon of July 3rd and at offensive operations at Gettysburg. You know what I'm saying, folks. He has the ability to do that up until the afternoon of July 3rd. He does not after July 3rd, and that frankly, July 3rd is what causes him to retreat. So I bring that up because, again, people are going to disagree, and that's cool, and that's part of the fun of debating this topic. But it's not all total BS like a lot of people probably think it is. You can indeed, and I don't want to hear, well, you know, Frazzanito says there were no photos of the high watermark, and that proves it wasn't important. I get it. But you can make a military case that, yes, folks, the afternoon of July 3rd, 1863 is the decisive moment at the Battle of Gettysburg. And I think we should talk on this at another time.
Well, I will just say, as my counterpoint to that, I'm not taking away anything of the importance of it. And I'm not one to really knock parts of this battle. I think there's a cottage industry where people want to say, well, this isn't as important.
Oh, my God, Little Round Top, yeah.
My thought process, if people are getting maimed and killed there,
it's all important.
It's important. To me, my personal belief, decisive moment of the Battle of Gettysburg, it's when Richard Ewell commits to the attack on July 1st. Well, if ever there's a chance for it to break off, that's that. But once again, another episode, time, but we're talking about Badger Batchelder today.
Yeah, and just for the clarity for the audience, you're right, there's decisive moments, but Batchelder considered this the high watermark, the turning point, and I think you can make a case that this is indeed the turning point. But all right, let's get into this some other time. Unless you got anything, you want to go to the 72nd PA while we're still in the high watermark area?
This is one that we got a lot of questions about. I think this is a well-known controversy, and frankly, in some respects, what a lot of people know John Batchelder for is this controversy involving the 72nd Pennsylvania. We could probably do an entire episode on this. I mean, there's a lot to unpack with it. But Jim, let's kind of give folks the quick overview of this and how is Batchelder involved?
Yeah. Let me think how I can do this simply. But what I think is it's not a well understood controversy. Okay, so again, for background here, for anybody who doesn't know, the 72nd Pennsylvania was one of the units in General Alexander Webb's brigade that was defending the area around the angle and the copse of trees and the high water mark on the afternoon of July 3rd, 1863. As the story has always gone, when General Webb saw the Confederates breaking through his lines at that point, the newly promoted General Webb ran up to the men of the 72nd Pennsylvania and ordered them to charge forward and, you know, basically stop this Confederate breakthrough. But for reasons that are still debated today, noise, smoke, chaos, confusion, Webb was new to command, Webb didn't go through proper channels, there's a lot of reasons why, but for reasons that are still debated today, the 72nd Pennsylvania apparently did not move forward. So Webb then went on to other units in his brigade, went over to the 69th near the copse of trees, and eventually the Confederate attack was repulsed. So with that as kind of the background, the veterans of the 72nd PA dedicated their first monument in the area of the high water mark in 1883. And it's still there today, but it's a fairly small and simple design. And I've actually measured it, and it's about 162 feet from the stone wall. It's kind of today just west of the sidewalk. Like when you're walking around by the copse of trees heading towards the angle, it's kind of just west of the sidewalk. But it's still there. It's not super prominent. You got to kind of look at it up close to kind of see who it commemorates. But anyways, that was the first monument that this unit placed in 1883. Trouble, though, began in May of 1887. So as we said, I think in the last episode, you know, the GBMA had basically resolved that regiments should place monuments on ground and would be required to, quote, locate and place them in the position held by the regiment in the line of battle. Well, this is happening, too, during an era when the popularity of Pickett's Charge and the high watermark, all of this stuff is going on at the same time. As Eric would say, it's a very fluid situation. So you got all this going on. The veterans decided that they wanted some form of marker closer to the wall itself. So as it so happened, the Pennsylvania State Legislature created a commission on monuments, and additional funds were appropriated to mark additional monument positions at Gettysburg. Perfect, right? The veterans think, hey, we want to be closer to the wall. The state has given us money to do this. We're going to do it. However, Batchelder, leading the charge for the GBMA, basically told the veterans, no, you didn't form at the wall in your brigade line of battle. You can put up another monument on the field. You can put up an advance marker, but you're not putting one at the wall because you did not defend it, in Batchelder's view, you did not defend it as an organized body during the repulse of Pickett's Charge.
What is interesting here, the 72nd Pennsylvania, that's a big monument. A compromise could have been put the big monument where your old one was,
right?
Move the old one up to the wall. But frankly, do the veterans want to move their small marker up to the wall? No, they want people to know they were at the wall. And it goes back to this idea of this area becomes so popularized that your unit's identification, if it can be associated to this spot, just adds luster to your organization.
To your fame.
And so, yeah, you want your soldier swinging that rifle at the wall. You don't want the small little advance marker there. You want the big honking monument right there where everybody can see it.
Exactly. So at one point, you know, veterans get a plot, you know, kind of just on the other side of the wall, and they try digging, you know, digging a hole for their foundation of their monument. Obviously, Batchelder's not happy with that. There was also, though, and this is, I think, the piece that kind of gets lost, because it's always portrayed, like you said, you know, kind of the old guide stories, like it's always the veterans versus stubborn old John Batchelder and that sort of thing. But there was a broader legal issue at play that frankly is not as exciting, but should be something that we talk about in the interest of factual accuracy. And the idea, the broader issue was, did the GBMA's charter give them the final authority on Pennsylvania soil to say where the monument would go, or did the state's new commission have the right to determine where a monument should go with publicly appropriated funds? And again, folks, that was really the real issue. Who had the say here? Was it the state or was it the GBMA? But of course, Batchelder, having a vested interest in this, you guys can pretty much figure out which side of the argument Batchelder was on. Okay, so in January of 1889, the veterans filed suit in Adams County Court to place their monument near the wall. The GBMA scored an early victory, though, when the local court dismissed the complaint in their favor, but the veterans were persistent and they appealed to the state Supreme Court in March, and the state reversed the lower court. So a trial began in the fall of 1889. Testimony was taken from both sides. And here's an interesting piece, which kind of goes back to what we were saying in part one about Batchelder, you know, not actually being here during the battle. Batchelder's testimony was thrown out as hearsay since he had not been present during the battle. So, you know, that's got to kind of sting a little bit. You're coming onto the stand in your official government historian championship belt, and the judge basically says, no, hearsay, dude, you're an artist. You weren't even at the battle.
And legally, it is hearsay. I mean, he didn't see it himself. What I envision is, you know, Batchelder just being livid over this. And, you know, and it's kind of funny. Local lawsuits, state Supreme Court lawsuits, stuff getting thrown out. I cannot relate November and December of 2020 about that going on in Pennsylvania. It seems so foreign today.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
It just seems so foreign. Not having standing? Who says that?
Nothing modern audiences could relate to.
No,
right?
We cannot connect this to any modern event whatsoever.
Good point. So ultimately, the final ruling came in March of 1891. It was in the regimental, the veterans' favor. The judge noted that the state had had superior authority over the GBMA, and then they added that the men of the 72nd surely deserved to have their position marked. So I do think there was a little sentimentality here, you know, in favor of the veterans that went into the final ruling. The GBMA did appeal the ruling, but it was dismissed after only 3 days. Newspapers generally applauded the verdict, and they kind of ridiculed Batchelder and the GBMA for this. So again, a proud, stubborn man like Batchelder getting ridiculed in court, getting ridiculed by the veterans, now getting mocked in the newspapers. I'm thinking that might have been a little bit of a rough patch for him.
And of course, just the more you know about Batchelder's personality, he's not backing down in these arguments. He is convinced he is right. He has put in the time. He has put in the effort. He has put in the legwork on the battlefield. And I don't care what you guys say. So he makes an easy target to be ridiculed in some respects. I mean, the stuffy historian. People always make fun of those guys, right?
Yes, right. And so ultimately, the 72nd Pennsylvania Monument was dedicated on July 4th, 1891. It's less than 20 feet away from the stone wall. As I think Eric said, if you don't know which one we're talking about, look it up. But it's a very prominent. It's right there. It's a soldier basically swinging his musket. I use it on almost every Pickett's Charge tour with the general public to show them the nature of the hand-to-hand fighting, to basically say, look, the veterans designed it like this to show you this was the nature of the hand-to-hand fighting. And frankly, guys, I'll add, as a historian, that unit did fight at the stone wall. They came up later. You could argue it was during the closing minutes of the charge, but the 72nd suffered some of the highest casualties in Webb's brigade. So there's no doubt that those guys didn't fight. It was just a question of, did their interpretation conform to John Batchelder's? And in this case, the state of Pennsylvania ruled in favor of the veterans.
Man, could you imagine if we would have to go to court over every historical interpretation we do?
I know, right? Could you imagine like a Dan Sickles court of law kind of
thing? I would love to have history court. Bring people up on charges of bad history. You know, that could be fun.
That could be a good podcast.
History court.
History court. Yeah,
yeah. It'd be like Law and Order, but, yeah, you know, Gettysburg Special Victims Unit. There we go.
Okay, so that was an example where Batchelder's version of historical interpretation did not win. And so, you know, you come to Gettysburg today, the average visitor is going to look at that unit and just think, oh, it was one of these regiments that fought at the wall. So Batchelder did not always get his way, and that's probably the most noteworthy example of it.
So while we're in the vicinity of Cemetery Ridge, the attack on July 3rd, Batchelder also gets into a bit of a controversy and butts heads with maybe one of Gettysburg's most beloved figures. Old Winnie Boy himself, Winfield Scott Hancock. Everyone is swooning right now at Hancock the Superb. Superfan MJ is going to ask about this issue that Hancock has with Batchelder in terms of the placement of where Hancock was wounded. Because I think it's kind of an interesting moment of, I was there, you weren't.
Yeah.
Batchelder saying, well, I've got more information than you do. And I think it's a fascinating look at some of these controversies that you do see at times that Batchelder deals with.
So, first of all, Eric has thrown out the challenge that he's going to grow his facial hair like Batchelder. I would say I would grow my facial hair like Hancock, although I feel like I'm kind of a little bit of Hancock-esque already right now. So, but, you know, maybe I'll trim it up a little bit to look more like old Winnie Boy, as you said.
So, wait a minute. If we get top 25?
Yes.
Will you do the Hancock facial hair?
That's right. That's right.
And, all right, folks.
And I'll allow people to call me Hessler the Superb. How about that?
And you know what we can do? We can then reenact an argument between Batchelder and Hancock on the spot if we get top 10. Folks, these are levels. If you help us get there, you will get good things. You will get good entertainment.
Our tiered levels of giving, so to speak.
Yes, this is like our own Patreon.
All right. So one of the things this whole Hancock Batchelder story kind of reminds me, it reminds me, we haven't done a lot of Hancock on the podcast. We should do something about that. But it also reminds me too, again, a good example, Batchelder touring the field with veterans and dignitaries. And again, there's a great, great example of this. Hancock returned to the field with Batchelder and others on November 19th and 20th, 1885, which would turn out to be less than 3 months before Hancock's death.
Hey, Remembrance Day, actually.
Oh, good point.
November 19th.
Yeah, good point. Day. Good point. Good time for old Winnie Boy to come back to town kind of thing. So today there's a small monument, and I haven't measured this one. It's a small monument many hundreds of yards south of the copse of trees. Kind of when you're making the turn on Hancock Avenue, passing the PA monument, you have like the Vermont monuments kind of over on your right. And there's a little marker to Hancock on the left-hand side of the avenue today, kind of nestled in with some trees and some rocks, that is supposed to indicate where he was wounded during the afternoon of July 3rd, 1863. Hancock, however, after touring the battlefield with Batchelder, was not happy at the location. And Hancock wrote, "I saw no great boulders in front of the Vermont Brigade or about it, and therefore I am satisfied that the position indicated where I was shot is incorrect. It was established in 1866 in the presence of several people, but is not placed as indicated on that field on my last visit." And folks, by the way, that letter is in Batchelder Papers 3, Volume 3, page 1949. So again, another way, which we'll get into later, of how you can use and benefit from the Batchelder Papers. Eric, what do we think?
It's a tough argument. You know, you've got the guy that's doing the research, that's talking to other people that clearly saw Hancock wounded in that area, yet Hancock himself is saying, wait a minute, this isn't where I was wounded. You know, actually, we do have in works a medical episode coming up with our friends, fellow guides Rick and Fran, both medical professionals. Maybe we can even ask about this. What's the impact of shock and blood loss on memory?
Be interesting.
You know, because I think, I don't know, if Hancock has just had a saddle nail, everything else, plus a bullet going into his hip, I don't know. Right now, hey, there's that boulder. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. Once again, he was there. I wasn't. John Batchelder wasn't there. But I think it is very interesting when, you know, I don't know if we'll ever have the definitive answer.
No.
You know, I mean, yeah. Because I think also if we would look at accounts of soldiers in that area that would say they saw Hancock wounded, then again, how many said they saw Reynolds get killed? Right. How many different Confederates claim credit for shooting Reynolds? You know, there's all these issues you run into, especially when it involves a famous individual and a moment like that. So, you know, I'm more willing to side a little more with Batchelder because he's trying to bring in as many witnesses as he can to put this together, whereas Hancock is just viewing it from his own issue. And also ask any legal professional the validity of an eyewitness statement.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, so just because Hancock's the guy wounded, he may not remember it correctly. As, say, somebody that was not injured and is looking in a clear state of mind.
Yeah. Now, both Hancock and his staff officer, C.H. Morgan, basically wrote that it occurred when Hancock was turning towards the clump of trees. He was talking to the Vermonters. He was talking to Stannard. And he basically turned by the right towards the clump of trees. And, as Hancock added, quote, "The place where I was shot is not presently marked, is not very accurately indicated. I saw no great boulder in the neighborhood. I was shot from my horse when leaving the Vermont position by its right." So, you know, to Eric's point, and he's totally right, you know, eyewitness testimony in of itself, as we know, especially, you know, many years afterwards, is not necessarily accurate. What this whole thing kind of just says to me, look, if you're just looking at this at the 10,000 foot level, who cares? You know, was he wounded here? Was he wounded there? But for those of us, our very own John Batchelders, who want to try to understand every detail that we can about this battle, I think kind of what the controversy says to me, either Hancock's wounding monument is in the wrong position or where the Vermont positions are marked are in the wrong position. Because today, to go from Vermont to Hancock, you'd have to turn by the left away from the copse of trees. So, you know, one of those is in the wrong position. And does that influence our interpretation of Pickett's charge? Again, at a 10,000 foot level, not really. But for those of us like Jim and like Eric and like Superfan MJ who want to get into the weeds, it does give you something to chew on.
And I think and we'll talk about this a little bit later, how to use these papers. These are things you can take away from the papers for further study.
Yeah.
These are things that can guide you in paths to looking at things. Because frankly, the battle is not this dogmatic sequence of events we like it to be. I would argue the history of this battle is forever changing. There's the basic details, but the hows and whys and whats, they're open to interpretation. So I think this is a great example of somebody could probably do some really good digging. Look at some sources from the Vermont Brigade. Look at some sources from Hancock's Corps and kind of combine them with what you're seeing and using Batchelder's papers as a guide for this. It gives you that starting point for further research, which I think is why these are so vitally important.
Dare I say, is a companion to the Battle of Gettysburg podcast when you listen.
Absolutely, absolutely. So we've touched on a number of the controversies and challenges that Batchelder has in his career. And as you know, we talked about in part one, Batchelder passes away in 1894. I'm not going to say he's been forgotten, but he's going to sort of fade away until the 1950s or so, when a professor by the name of Edwin Coddington is researching a campaign history of the Battle of Gettysburg. Now, what Coddington sets out to do, which I think is very admirable, he wants to use sources that have not really been gleaned before, looked at before. He doesn't want to use the same old stuff because, frankly, how many times do you see the same stuff popping up over and over and over again? So I commend Coddington. I think that's why his work stands the test of time.
That's why he's Coddington.
Yeah, it's why it's still, in my opinion, the best. So the best account we have of how Coddington discovers Batchelder is from the actual acknowledgments in Coddington's book. And I always tell people, read everything in the book. Don't just assume it's acknowledgments, that it's just a bunch of thank yous, because there's some really good stuff here. Coddington's going to write, "In seeking new sources of information about the Battle of Gettysburg, my attention early turned to one Colonel John B. Batchelder, whose name was occasionally mentioned in the correspondence of participants as an authority on the engagement. Very few 20th century scholars cited him, and those who did seemed to have no idea of who he really was. As late as 1962, the historians at the Gettysburg National Military Park had only vague notions about him."
Wow.
Folks, a year before the 100th anniversary of this battle, he's not even on the radar of park historians. So this is why this is so groundbreaking. What Batchelder comes to show is this wealth of untapped resources that Coddington is going to use.
Yeah, exactly right. And you know, so again, I know some listeners at home who, again, are very Gettysburg-centric people might be going like, oh my God, how could this have happened, you know, kind of thing. Well, again, as we touched on, Batchelder's wife died in 1914. Their daughter Charlotte had died tragically at the age of 13. Kind of not clear to me if there's a son in the picture or not. But around 1921, Mrs. Batchelder's sisters donated a large majority of this work to the New Hampshire Historical Society. And, you know, like often happens in local historical societies, they just sat there, forgotten, unused, collecting dust. Now, the other thing I want to add, too, Eric talked about, you know, the name Batchelder then was coming to Coddington's attention as he was doing his research. One of the stories is that Coddington's daughter found a Batchelder pamphlet in a New York antique shop, one describing the 1870 Walker painting, The Repulse of Longstreet's Charge. So once again, you know, I kind of made a joke out of it earlier, but this 1870 Walker painting about Longstreet's assault keeps kind of coming back into the picture here. It is one of the things that got Batchelder rediscovered for this 20th century historian, Coddington.
And today, one of the most prestigious awards in Civil War books is the Batchelder Coddington Award. And I seem to think there's somebody in the studio right now that has been the recipient of that a handful of times.
Oh, stop. I'm blushing,
I'm
Eric.
Just saying. Just to make it come full circle to 2020.
Well, thank you. First of all, no, folks, I did not put Eric up to that. Thank you, Eric, for spontaneously doing that. Yes, my Sickles at Gettysburg about 10 years ago won the Batchelder Coddington Award, but most recently, Britton Mize Gettysburg Beech Orchard also won the Batchelder Coddington Award. It is a prestigious Award, a high honor given out by the Robert E. Lee Civil War Roundtable. And the great thing about that award is, you know, when I put it on my biography resume and I see other people trying to read and fumble around with the names Batchelder, Coddington in one sentence, you kind of learn pretty quickly who in the Civil War Roundtable community has no idea who John Batchelder is, because you watch him mangle that name in almost every conceivable way.
You mean Bach Elder?
Exactly. Stuff like that.
And yes, that was a gratuitous plug.
But thank you for it.
But nonetheless, I mean, hey, it's our show. We can plug whatever we want.
And we're free.
We are speaking as individuals.
Exactly. And it's free.
So. And it's free. So, but I think what it shows is that I think if you did have to say who is the greatest 19th century historian of the battle, clearly it's John Batchelder. And I would argue a 20th century historian whose work is probably the most definitive, I think you have to go Coddington. I mean, I think you could make Harry Fonz an argument with him, but I think Coddington writes a complete history.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, taking nothing away from someone like Harry Fonz, who I would put right there.
Right.
I mean, believe me, in my Mount Rushmore of Gettysburg historians, Fonz is on it.
Oh, hell yeah.
So, you know, I don't want people to think, oh, he's bashing Fonz. No, I'm just saying, but I think in terms of the two greatest historians of the 19th century and the 20th century, you got to go with Coddington for the 20th, and sure, you got to go with Batchelder for the 19th.
I would totally agree with you on that. And, you know, not to get too far down the Coddington rabbit hole, because we should probably do a Coddington episode sometime.
Yeah, we've actually talked about reading some of these accounts and kind of breaking them down and look at their sources and things, which, you know, it may be us getting way into the weeds, but I think it could be fun.
I think
because,
people would like that.
You know, these are things that we all have read, we recommend people to read, mm-hmm, for us to kind of go back and look at it and really break them down, not just, you know, take it at face value.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the only thing I'll sort of whet the appetite with right now is, you know, my jimmies get rustled a little bit when I see people like on social media saying, oh, Coddington is so dry. Oh, I like Sears and Trudeau for the human interest stories. And all joking aside, I get it. I'm not diminishing the importance of human interest. But, you know, Coddington, first of all, did a study in command. So he's not here to tell you about Jenny Wade and Tilly Pierce and stuff like that. That wasn't Coddington's objective. But yeah, as we've touched on, he is the one to discover and use John Batchelder's notes.
Every major history of the Battle of Gettysburg written since Coddington uses the Batchelder papers.
Yep.
And frankly, if I pulled out a history today and did not consult them, I would seriously question the validity of the work being put forward.
Right.
It is the campaign study that all campaign studies are measured against. And to me, it really is the fulfillment of what the government intended in 1880.
Exactly.
I think this is what they were hoping comes out. So, you know, it is, I would argue, you know, actually on my bookshelf at home, the way I have it in order is I have the three Batchelder mm-hmm. papers, I have Batchelder's history, and right beside it, I have Coddington.
Yeah.
That's the way I organize it on my book.
Sure, fair enough.
I think because they're connected, that you cannot really look at them as separate in many respects.
Yeah, totally agree on that. So yes, whether or not you think Coddington is dry, we owe that guy a huge debt, huge to Gettysburg scholarship.
Well, heck, how many tours I've done that I've used something from the Batchelder papers? How many ranger programs use things from the Batchelder papers? I mean, it is... It's everywhere.
All three, yeah, not only tours, but all three of my published books, I mean, relied heavily on them. Sickles material, Pickett's Charge material, Peach Orchard material, all three of my published books relied heavily on Batchelder. I could not possibly imagine what these things would have looked like without them. So, you know, again, not to get on a different soapbox, but when people say stuff like, oh, Shelby Foote is my favorite Gettysburg historian. Really, guys? Shelby Foote might be your favorite Gettysburg storyteller, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. But best Gettysburg historian? Not even by a long shot.
And maybe we get into that when we've talked about doing a watch-along of Ken Burns' Gettysburg section, later in the season. So maybe we'll get into that a little bit later. So this is a good segue now, I think, because we've had a lot of listener questions.
Yeah.
A lot of people have gotten their copies of the Batchelder papers, which kudos to Savis Beatty for putting this thing back out there and making it accessible again. I mean, I think that is, you know, wonderful. And people are, it's bringing it to a new audience in some respects. I mean, it wasn't, what, mid-90s? It comes out 94, 95-ish in that ballpark.
Yeah.
I mean, we're looking now, that's almost a generation ago these came out.
Right.
So now it's being issued to a new generation, new people looking at it.
Yeah.
So a lot of people said, okay, we've got these three volumes. Now what? What do we do? Do we just read them, you know, cover to cover?
Is it like Sears and Trudeau? Do I just read it at bedtime?
How the heck do we use this? Yeah. How do we use this tool that we all now have in
our
toolbox?
Where are the human interest stories? Yeah.
So we're going to give you kind of some insight into that, at least how we've used them before.
Right.
And we'll also talk about some of our favorite accounts from the Batchelder papers. But we did have a listener question from Superfan Bob that is looking at his copy of the Batchelder papers. I'm certainly he is excited to have them. And he says, the organization of the volumes by date of receipt of letters is curious and not terribly user-friendly. How did they come to be published in this form?
All
well,
right.
Simply put, if you go through most archival letter collections, they are organized by date of receipt.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not by subject necessarily. It's by date, which can be challenging sometimes because it's not thematic. It's chronological. So
you don't have really, all your Hancock stuff together, but it's by date.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it is, yes, I will agree that it can be not user-friendly. I will argue they have a wonderful index in the back that makes it, if you do want to look it up by subject.
Right.
And, you know, so it is, there is still a usability there, but you know, when they were compiling this, they're following the way these letters were organized in the Historical Society. That's what it is.
Yeah,
so
right.
I think you have to kind of look at that. If anybody that's dealt with archival letter collections, that's how they do it. It's standard protocol.
Yeah, and you're right. And so just to break this down for folks, and before we go on, I do want to add that Savis Beatty is doing another printing of this. So if you missed out, contact Savis Beatty. Tell him you want to get on the list for not even a new round of Batchelder papers, but also the Batchelder government history. And you're welcome, Ted. But okay.
And also, tell them that Eric and Jim sent you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. But so back to the papers themselves. Yeah. They're broken up into three volumes. Volume 1 runs from January 5th, 1863 to July of 1880. Yes, folks, there is the first letter and one or two things do actually predate the Battle of Gettysburg. And for Trivial Pursuit, if nothing else, the first letter dated January 5th, 1863 is from John C. Caldwell, endorsing Batchelder's sketches of Seven Pines or Fair Oaks. So again, as we touched on, you know, Batchelder had this interest in the peninsula in the Seven Days. The Caldwell letter really doesn't tell you much. It just is endorsing Batchelder's work. But again, it kind of shows you that, again, we were thinking prior to Gettysburg.
And it shows Batchelder being in the loop pre-Gettysburg.
Yep.
So these are, Batchelder is not a foreign person to many of these notables that we have at Gettysburg.
So Volume 1 again runs to the summer of 1880. Volume 2 picks up in September of 1880, goes through April of 86. And then last but not least, Volume 3 runs from April of 86 to November of 93. Remember, he dies in 1894. And then there's some supplementary appendices in there as well. So I've always said, you know, and I had the original 1994 set, so I've been using these things for 25 years. They're fantastic. But I always said, as you can imagine, with a chronological order like that, Volume 1 and the beginning of Volume 2 are easily the best and the most useful of the three volumes. You know, by about the middle of Volume 2 to Volume 3, starts to get a little repetitive, starts to drop off a little bit in quality. Again, that's not to say you won't find some good stuff in Volume 3. You will. But given the chronological orientation, you know, if you're trying to figure out, okay, how do I dive into these things, your biggest bang for your buck is going to be read Volume 1 and about the first half of Volume 2. And if you're still alive, then continue on to the end of Volume 3.
What I find interesting is following Batchelder's correspondence that he's writing out, you can sometimes see the development of his thinking on the battle, that you're following it chronologically, you're not looking at it thematically, where you can start to see, okay, how's he forming his thoughts on things? And one of the things that I think separates us from a lot of other history podcasts is that we delve into the why, not so much the what.
Mm-hmm.
And that involves seeing how thought process develops, how historical arguments develop. Yeah. And that's really what you can see. So for me, I don't, back to the original listener question, I don't necessarily think it's user unfriendly that it's in chronological order.
Yeah, it is what it is.
It is what it is. But I think with the index, if it didn't have an index, I would say this is a pain in the ass. Yeah. But I think it is interesting because you can see this great historian's thoughts developing. And I think that's something that's very interesting to track at times. And, you know, and I'm also interested sometimes, too, when you see someone that publishes a work, but it was part of their thesis when they were, say, in grad school.
Yeah.
It's sometimes cool to go back and read the thesis and see how that evolves what's the work today. Right. I mean, to me, that interests me as a historian.
Yeah, I mean, a great example of the evolution. I mean, we've touched on this, I think, in part one, and I've got a special letter that I want to close the show with. But using an example of the evolution, 1889. When Batchelder is canvassing veterans for their opinions on marking Confederate lines at Gettysburg, you see these letters kind of grouped together in the back end of Volume 3. And that's exactly right. You kind of see themes going back and forth. You know, he's corresponding at different times with, like, I'll just throw a name out, Edward Porter Alexander. So you'll see a couple of Alexander letters going back and forth. You know, maybe not back to back, but within a few pages of each other. And you're right, it kind of gives you a good window into, okay, what was Batchelder digging into at this time? And again, the 1889 Confederate lines of battle would just be one of many examples of that.
And also, what is Alexander thinking at that time? You know, I mean, it's interesting to track Alexander's thoughts and some of these other individuals' thoughts based on their writings. It gives you a window into their thought process.
Well, that's an example of, you know, you look at a guy like Alexander. He's got Battles and Leaders. He's got multiple memoirs or that. I always tell people, I mean, me and some friends were debating the Counter March a number of years ago, and they were very well versed in all of Alexander's published stuff. But I said, well, what about his Batchelder letter? And they were like, huh? They didn't know about the Batchelder letter. But the point being, yeah, you know, we're familiar with what these guys ultimately published. And as we know, what they published could be influenced by editors. It could be influenced by what they wanted for public consumption. But yeah, you get lengthy Alexander letters in the Batchelder papers. You can kind of see his unpublished view at a particular point in time on what he was thinking about Longstreet's assault and the various Lee Longstreet stuff and a little bit about the countermarch. I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, as we like to say on the show.
And sometimes these letters, the authors of them are not writing it assuming it's going to be for public consumption. So they can be sometimes a little more candid what you would write in, say, your memoir or something to Battles and Leaders that you know would be for mass publication. So, yeah, it's an interesting insight. And as we talk about historical interpretation changes, often in the minds of the participants, their role changes. And so it's a good insight into that that you can really trace. Mm-hmm. Once again, the historiography, I think this is what separates the armchair amateur historians from those that are really doing this, I think, at a professional level. And this is anybody that wants to take that step from being a buff to, I mean, really get into this, you got to delve into the historiography. That's what separates historians from just a guy that reads history. And so I would say, you know, delve into that. It's also fascinating. It'll change the way you view this battle. It'll change the way you view individuals for better or worse. And it's something you really have to do. It's something that I wish I would see our guides do more of, as well as even our rangers do more of. I think it's a challenge even for us that do this day in and day out to really delve into this, because history is not a simple answer. And also, it's not an answer of, well, okay, which answer did they give and when? So there's a lot for us to delve into sometimes in these subjects that we know the big picture, but some of these nuts and bolts are really where you earn your pay.
Yeah, and so with that as sort of the segue, I thought it would be kind of interesting. I had picked out, you know, again, I've used this stuff heavy in my research over the years. You know, I said to Eric, hey, why don't we each one of us just sort of pick out 5 or 6 examples from the Batchelder papers that we like? Maybe we've found it useful over the years. Maybe we like the person who wrote it, but just pick out 5 or 6 examples each from the Batchelder Papers, we can kind of highlight for the listeners and the readers of this work some of the stuff that's incorporated. Now, some of these letters are very lengthy, and that's a good thing. Like, obviously, again, if you're saying, okay, how do I use the Batchelder Papers? You know, obviously, the ones that are quite lengthy are going to go into some meat and potatoes of battle. You know, there's a lot of snippets of, oh, yeah, Batchelder, you know, your isometric map is the finest thing out there. It was a kaleidoscope whirl and all that stuff. And all that stuff is fine, and it's all in there, and you can see who endorsed them. But there's some really long letters in here that go into great, great detail. And again, you guys, it's eyewitness participants in the Battle of Gettysburg, in many cases writing within days, weeks, or months of the battle. For example, my first selection, Volume 1, page 17, is a letter that is reprinted from General Alexander Webb to his wife, July 6, 1863, basically 3 days after he is repulsed, what we're still going to call today Pickett's Charge. So it's a fairly detailed letter. Not only does he talk about Pickett's Charge, but in this letter, Webb gives an account of Wright's attack on the afternoon of July 2nd and how Wright's assault slammed into Webb's lines. And among other things, he talks about that the rebels came roughly 25 yards from him. They staggered, they wavered, they fled from his volleys, i.e. no indication whatsoever that Wright broke his lines, which again, as some of us know, wink, wink, is a modern controversy. But then July 3rd, Webb talks graphically about how close he felt that he was to being utterly defeated when the Confederates broke through his lines on July 3rd. So we always talk about Pickett's Charge being this lopsided Union victory, but you have the guy who defended the angle feeling that he was almost totally defeated when my two companies were driven out and my artillery was in the enemy's hands. Last but not least, he touches on General Armistead. And again, often get involved with debates who say, no, 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 Armistead fell right at the wall. He was turning a cannon. He fell at the wall. Webb says on July 6th, General Armistead came over my fence and passed me with four of his men before being mortally wounded. So that to me sounds like Armistead is in motion and basically running by him. And afterwards, Webb says to his wife that he counted and killed 42 dead rebels inside the fence. I mean, holy cow, there's a lot to unpack there. And in the interest of time, we're not going to unpack it all. But folks, that's Batchelder Volume 1, page 17 to get you started.
So a lot of my picks are ones that have formed, you know, the way I think about the battle, accounts I use when I give tours, or ones that just have a personal connection to me in some ways. My first pick, and I think this is going to be a common theme, Volume 1, pages 48 through 58. What these consist of is a letter from Lieutenant George Benedict to Batchelder, as well as Brigadier General George Stannard's diary from the Gettysburg campaign. Why am I picking these random Vermonters? Everybody thinks of me as, okay, he only thinks about North Carolina and North Carolina alone. But I have always had a soft spot in my heart for Union troops from Vermont. The 9th Vermont occupied my hometown, North Carolina. They were the subject of my first book. And also, George Stannard was the first colonel of the 9th Vermont. Mm-hmm. Later, a source that I used heavily in my Newport Barracks book was George Benedict's later work on Vermont troops in the Civil War. So these are guys that I got to know very early in my sort of formation as a historian. So they kind of seen them mentioned here in this Gettysburg context, kind of, oh, that's cool. I like to see what these guys are doing. And also, I always love the story of Stannard and the 9th Vermont. Uh-huh. So, you know, and what Stannard goes on to do after the Maryland campaign. So also what you get immediately on page 49, you get this hand-drawn map between the Emmitsburg Road and the Taneytown Road, looking at the positioning of the Vermont Brigade, where their skirmishers are. I mean, you can take this out onto the field and walk their line if you want to. I mean, and this is, you know, Benedict's letter is dated Christmas Eve, 1863. This isn't some guy writing just a handful of years later. It's, you know, within a couple months. So that's my first pick, is one that I really like, because I find the 2nd Vermont Brigade fascinating, what they do here at Gettysburg. I've long said the Vermont Brigade, I think, is the finest Union brigade in the Civil War, the 1st Vermont Brigade. So, yeah, it just kind of taps into my soft spot for the state of Vermont.
So, a couple thoughts there. People often ask us if this show is scripted, and we always say, no, it's not. You know, we come in with some ideas of what we're going to talk about, and we go through it. But how crazy is this? That of the three volumes in literally, I don't know, a couple thousand pages here to choose from, we both randomly chose George Stannard's diary entry that's in volume 1 and page 50. So maybe this is why Eric and I work so well together. We did not rehearse that. We did not plan it. We did not say what the other one was looking for. We both chose Stannard's diary, volume 1, page 50, but for different reasons.
Yeah, and for me, I mean, I picked it because I knew Benedict. I knew Stannard. Yeah, yeah. So that's kind of interesting. Hey, what are they doing here at Gettysburg? And, you know, so that was to me interesting. Also, the first time we knew what we picked was when we got in here and said, okay, this is what I was going with. What did you go with? Just so we kind of have a sense of it. But it wasn't like I texted Jim, hey, I'm going Benedict.
We did not do so.
We didn't know until we got in here. So
there's a couple things I like about Stannard's entry. You know, first of all, he talks about the marching conditions as they Monday, June 29th, as they're heading towards Gettysburg. You know, he talks about how hard it was. He talks about the roads were very muddy. Men were falling out, you know, especially after they left Frederick. And this is a quote I used in my picket book and I use on tours. I think whiskey the cause. They marched until this time first rate. They count their time by days. Consequently, they do not have any heart in the work, officers as little as men. But the second reason why I like that letter is because, you know, you often get out there, you stand out near the Vermont monuments, you're trying to imagine what Kemper's brigade might have looked like it was as it was sweeping by. And Stannard gives us descriptions of that. And he talks about Kemper's guys passing them and then turning and then getting hit with a volley and then passing again. You know, because, you know, Kemper's brigade movements left of themselves can really be kind of confusing, but here you have Brigadier General George Stannard of the Vermont Brigade basically telling us what it looked like, and it starts on Volume 1, page 50 of the Batchelder Papers.
So I guess I'll continue on with my next pick, or do you want to go with your pick?
No, we'll just alternate. You want it?
Okay, yeah.
It's like the fantasy draft,
yeah,
right?
So yeah. I guess since we kind of had the combined one, I'll just now come in.
Oh, okay. No, that was my – I'll consider that like a pick of mine too. So
okay.
We're good. Yeah,
all right,
go
so we have the dual pick.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
My next entry is from Volume 1, pages 256 to 259, and it is a letter of Colonel William Colville.
Yeah, right.
First Minnesota fame. Writing from Red Wing, Minnesota on June 9th, 1866. And I think what we see is he really paints the desperate picture. And this is a story that I love to talk about on tours, the charge of the First Minnesota. Mm-hmm. At some point, we should do a First Minnesota episode, or at the very least that attack on Cemetery Ridge on July 2nd. And I think what we see is it captures the just seriousness and I think desperate nature of the moment. Colville's own words talk about when Hancock rides up, he says, "My God, are these all the men we have here?" referring to my regiment. And then it says he gave the order, "Advance, Colonel, and take those colors." You know, and I just think about that. What a dramatic scene that is painting, the 262 men of the 1st Minnesota charging headlong into Cadmus Wilcox's Alabamians. I mean, it just shows you the, you know, we like to think of Hancock as being kind of cool, calm, and collected on a battlefield. You know, there's one account where one of his staffers said, "We always felt safe in the presence of the general." Here's Hancock, I think, on July 2nd. He's not cool, calm, and collected because he's trying to save that line on Cemetery Ridge. I think it speaks to that of the, oh, my God, this is all we have left? Mm-hmm. And then, well,
Here
we go. Yep. You know, and I think it just speaks to that. And I think it's a, you know, once again, this is not the interpretation of a historian. This is the memory of the colonel,
the
of
guy
the men
who
that
got
gave
the order,
you
absolutely.
Know, and I think there's a power to that. And he talks about that. He talks about some of the names and folks in there, and it gives you just kind of his recollection, which I think is incredibly powerful. And when you know, use that, I sometimes use the Hancock quote, "My God, is this all the men we have here?" I think that speaks to the moment and the importance of the first Minnesota. I am one that, you know, you can sometimes argue, well, was it really as important as some would be? You know, there are other troops coming up. You know what? In that moment, Hancock certainly thinks it's important.
You're damn right.
Hancock thinks the first Minnesota is all that's standing between the Confederates and Cemetery Ridge.
And
you got to go with that.
And I'm going to use that philosophy again when we do our East Cavalry Field episode. So table that too for future. Yeah, so my third pick was, again, another one that I've referred to very frequently in all of my published work that might not be as readily known to people. It's on Volume 1. It's another lengthy one, Volume 1, beginning on page 187. And it is an account written in May of 1865 from Lieutenant Colonel Clark Baldwin of the 1st Massachusetts. Okay, you might be saying, who, what? You know, what's so significant about that? But I use that on many occasions for a couple reasons. First, like the Standard account, he gives quite a bit of lead up on the march into Gettysburg, you know, talking about the condition of the men and the marching and all of that stuff. And, you know, I always like dirt that kind of shows these guys as real people. That's why I liked Standard's whiskey quote. But Baldwin mentions that on July 1st, as they're kind of moving into action, he talks about, quote, the column being led by a staff officer who was more noted for froth and foam than for common sense, although being a West Pointer and on a major general's staff. So I kind of like those human moments or that. But really on July 2nd, I think Baldwin provides the best account of action on a skirmish line, not only along the Third Corps front at Gettysburg, but I would argue and the best account of skirmishing that I can think of at the Battle of Gettysburg itself. You know, and that's skirmishing, you know, people ask about it on tours, where was the skirmish line, or when you walk Pickett's Charge and you pass, you know, the one marker that's out on the field to the Union skirmish line, and people say, wow, there was Union skirmishers out here along the Emmitsburg Road on July 2nd or that thing. And Baldwin tells us a lot about it, you know, and he talks about from each company, I threw forward 5 men to act as skirmishers, 25 yards to the front with instructions to keep themselves well covered. So he's really kind of going through the tactics and the command and the orders of the skirmish line, but then he also follows with a great account of fighting and the mistakes that often happen in the chaos and, shall we say, the fluidity of battle. And he talks about being ordered to form in the front of the 26th Pennsylvania by orders from General Carr, and still thinking it was wrong, I asked who gave the order, and I was told it came from General Carr. And then he talks about, you know, basically how they are not only unable to fire, but the volleys that they receive, and it's just good stuff in terms of marching, skirmishing, fighting, and the chaos of battle. So check out Lieutenant Colonel Clark Baldwin, 1st Massachusetts, Volume 1, page 187. Eric, who's your next choice?
My next pick, going back to Volume 1, and folks, this is not Eric's lazy and only looked at Volume 1 for this. It's just, I think, for me, a lot of the more powerful accounts are Volume 1. It's the right time for these guys to still be around. The longer you get, the more of these guys fade away. But I'm going with an account from Colonel George McFarland of the 151st Pennsylvania. Find that Volume 1, pages 270 through 272. Okay. And what it includes is a letter of McFarland to Batchelder, but it also is notes from a conversation that Batchelder has with McFarland in the role of the 151st Pennsylvania on McPherson's Ridge. And I have long said the focus of the fighting on McPherson's Ridge in the afternoon has been so Iron Brigade centric that people joke about an onslaught of sickles. I would argue it's an onslaught of Iron Brigade. And taking nothing away from those guys, there are other troops that fight on McPherson's Ridge on July 1st than the Iron Brigade.
Can we just sprinkle in a little bit of Buford, too? Buford and the Iron Brigade?
Let's put some Buford dust on it as well. You know, I mean, it's like, if you think about it, some people believe the only units that fought on July 1st is John Buford and the Iron Brigade. And at some point, Reynolds gets killed. Well, you know what? You got Roy Stone's guys.
Yeah.
You got Chapman Biddle's brigade fighting out there. And I think you have one of the more heroic stands of the battle in the 151st Pennsylvania. This is a 9-month regiment. Their service ends at the end of July. And here you have this wave of Confederates. They're seeing Pettigrew's guys coming across. They're seeing the 11th and 26th North Carolina almost to the edge of the woods now. They see Brockenbrough's men. They see Junius Daniels' men coming along the Chambersburg Pike. And this regiment is there to stop them and save time, to save the bacon of Stone's men, to save the bacon of Biddle, and to save the bacon of the Iron Brigade. These are the guys that bailed the Iron Brigade out on McPherson's Ridge. And McFarland gives a fascinating account, very detailed, of where they go and what they're doing. One of the interesting things for me is this helps me better understand Confederate accounts. As many of you know, I have immersed myself in the 26th North Carolina here at this battle. Well, I still have questions of where did these guys get on the field, and what we see from these correspondence, these notes, is it said that we became engaged immediately with Pettigrew's victorious troops whose advance had reached and occupied the point of the woods and protected by the trees delivered a fire so deadly that a single company, Company D, 12 were killed and 11 were wounded out of 38 men engaged. This was unquestionably the culminating moment of the first day's battle. Now, what this shows is, let's go look on the battlefield. Where's the 151st Pennsylvania's monument? It's in the inside of the Herbst Wood Line. Well, McFarland's kind of saying that's occupied by Confederates. We might be advancing to maybe what's today Reynolds Avenue. But what it shows is this very heroic stand, this rough fight, and I think the casualties suffered by the 151st that, frankly, do not get enough credit. I mean, the park has done programs, Last March of the Iron Brigade, and all this stuff. I'm never seeing Pettigrew programs. I'm never seeing Last Stand of the 151st Pennsylvania. And what this does is it adds more context to what happens on that part of the field than what the common interpretation usually is.
Boy, I can't argue with any of that. And I'll add an affinity I have to the 151st PA, because in Company K, there was First Lieutenant Jacob J. Hessler. I know a little bit about him. I can't prove yet if we're kin, but, you know, I've done a little bit. He was a prominent guy in the area, and he survived the war and all that. But
okay,
yeah.
Good. So the 26th didn't kill him?
No, the 26th did not kill him.
Okay, good. That would make things awkward.
No, that would be a rough patch here on the show.
Okay, good. Glad he survived.
Speaking of North Carolina troops, my next choice, you know, folks might be saying, well, geez, you know, Jim and Eric, you're being awful Union-centric, where are the Confederate accounts sort of thing. As we indicated, I believe, in part one, you know, Batchelder's work is more Union-focused, especially at the beginning, but that does not mean the Confederate accounts are absent. They are not. And I think especially as you get into the 1870s, you start to see your Edward Porter Alexanders and such show up in the Batchelder papers. And probably not surprising, another prolific Confederate contributor is former Brigadier General Joseph Kershaw. Now, Kershaw, if you guys, you know, he's another prolific writer. If you haven't read Kershaw in Battles and Leaders, then you really need to go back and do that. So he's a good writer. He's an articulate guy. Again, I've used his accounts not only in my Wheatfield-related battlefield tours, but also, again, Kershaw was an important character in my Peach Orchard book. So it's not surprising that Kershaw has several great letters in Batchelder. And for today, I'm going to refer to his letter dated March 20th, 1876, volume 1, page 452. Now, Eric, besides Kershaw's actions leading up to the Wheatfield and the Stony Hill, one of the reasons why I like this letter is because he describes the countermarch. Longstreet's countermarch, you know, one of those sort of interesting sidebars on the afternoon of July 2nd, 1863. You know, it's one of those little mystery puzzles on how Longstreet did or didn't get to the field that, you know, is always kind of just an interesting puzzle to solve. But what a lot of students don't realize is there are not a lot of firsthand accounts of the countermarch. I mean, I often get friends or colleagues who say, well, I'm going to read up everything on the countermarch. And I'm like, okay, that should take you like 10 minutes. because there really isn't a lot. But one of the instances where there is an account, Kershaw, March of 1876, the Batchelder Papers. So when he describes the counter march, Kershaw describes passing the Black Horse Tavern. Quote, some 300 yards from the hospital, when the head of the column was about to reach the top of the hill where it could be seen, McLaws halted the troops and with Longstreet went over the hill along the road we were on. In a few minutes, not five, both returned. McLaws ordered countermarch, and we filed to the rear, passing nearly on the same ground as before. Now, he goes into a lot more detail both before and after that, which, again, I think I'll save at this time for either when I do my countermarch tour or when we do our episode on the same topic, which is another one we've talked about doing for a while. So there, I think, is the first Confederate choice that we have on the board today, a letter from Kershaw. And again, not even because of what he talks about the battle, but because of what he tells us about the countermarch.
And this is going to shock some folks. I actually do not have a single Confederate account on my list. They are all Union accounts. But I am a strong proponent of sometimes to understand the action of Confederates, you need to read how those actions were viewed and interpreted by Union forces. A good example of that is what happens during Pickett's charge. Some units, like the 26th North Carolina, there's not a lot of good accounts. We only have a handful of them. And over time, we see more post-war accounts kind of coming in and coloring how we view this. So my next pick is actually from Volume 2, is a letter from Major Samuel Roberts. Mm-hmm. Samuel Roberts is in the 72nd Pennsylvania. And what he's going to be talking about on page 967 is of particular interest to me because he's going to talk about what's happening in that section of the line, basically from Arnold's Battery over to what you're going to see with the Bryan Farm. And the account, he was in contact with a member of the 12th New Jersey. And I asked him how far beyond the Emmitsburg Road the enemy advanced. He replied, at the moment the enemy broke, he had penetrated to within 20 feet of the line in his onward rush, but no further. Several Confederates had been struck by boulders hurled at them by some of the 12th New Jersey, who either had no time to reload their pieces or out of ammunition. So, to me, who are those troops attacking the 12th New Jersey? It's the 26th North Carolina. And here's this account of guys in the 12th New Jersey not only pouring buck and ball into these guys, but hurling rocks at them. This is brutal because we later have a vision of as the 26th gets up to the 12th New Jersey's line. I think this is when Shelby Foote even says, you know, they put the flag on the wall and the guy reaches out his hand and says, come over on this side of the Lord.
See, I do the same thing on my tours. I tell that in my Shelby Foote voice.
Yeah, come on over. And here's the thing. I have no account from the 12th New Jersey saying that they're offering any quarter to the 26th North Carolina on their front. One soldier says they only came up to our position but to die. And here we have them throwing rocks. This is not offering peace. This is brutal fighting. It's really its most basic form, hurling rocks at somebody. And I think it just shows, once again, about the desperate nature of the Union defense there. It's not an easy repulse. And what we see is this further verifies the 26th makes that further push than maybe the rest of some of Marshall's brigade. So one that I've always looked to that kind of influenced my thoughts in that part of the battle.
Yeah, no doubt. All right, so my next choice, I am going back to the Yankees, and I am also going to go for Volume 2 as well, Volume 2, page 771, and a letter from Captain Frank Moran of the 73rd New York. And Eric, this letter is not written to John Batchelder, it's written to Dan Sickles, but it is part of the Batchelder collection. The thing I like about this one is, first of all, as I said before, you look for lengthy letters. This one is 17 pages long, so it's got a lot of detail, goes into a lot of stuff that I can't go into right now for the time. But what I like about it, being somebody who's always been interested in the Peach Orchard and the fighting along the Emmitsburg Road, Captain Moran describes in great detail what it was like for the 73rd New York to go into action along the Emmitsburg Road near the Scherfey property. And he says that the Mississippi Brigade, quote, came swarming up the slope, yelling like devils and led by Barksdale. For a few impatient minutes, our regiments were unable to return a shot. The 114th Pennsylvania, being yet in our front, so that it was impossible to fire upon the enemy without shooting our friends in the back altogether. We stood in a shower of bullets from front and a merciless storm of bursting shells from Longstreet's batteries on our left. I mean, like, when I stand in that field kind of out near the Wentz house today, I read this quote and I really can kind of imagine what that was like. Beyond that, though, Moran was wounded in the action, and he describes it, quote, "A shell burst near our group, a fragment wounded my ankle. At the same time, something like hot sand entered my left eye." And I love that quote, hot sand. I mean, if you want to know what it's like to get artillery shrapnel in the eye, I guess it's like having hot sand thrown in your face. And Moran tells us that fortunately he did survive the wound, because he went on to do things like write this great 1882 letter to Dan the Man Sickles.
So my last selection comes from volume 3. So I've covered all three Good. Volumes. And you will find the selection on pages 1513 to 1517. So 1513 to 1517. And it's written by Private Horace Judson of Company K of the 8th Ohio. What I love is that he's writing this as Private Horace Judson. He's going to end the letter signing it, "Respectfully yours, Dr. Judson."
Ah, nice.
So yeah, the guy goes on to be a doctor after the war. And, you know, I think that's kind of, we sometimes think about what these guys do after, and I like that. But he gives a really great account of what the 8th Ohio is doing from a private's view. So much of what we view a battle from is the officers, you know, higher up in the ranks.
Right.
We don't see about the guys on the firing line. And so it's a really great account of the 8th Ohio and what they do here. But what I love is that attached is the breakdown that he gives of the forces in Pickett's charge. And how I stumbled on this was actually when I was doing research for my Newport Barracks book.
Mm-hmm.
Two of the units in that battle were the 17th and 42nd North Carolina. I see this notation that they somehow show up in Batchelder's papers. I'm going, what? They weren't at Gettysburg. So I'm like, I got to look at this. I look at it, and what Judson did was clearly was looking at something probably officially reported. At one point, the 42nd and 17th North Carolina were part of James Martin's brigade, which part of that gets folded into Pettigrew's brigade. So here we get these two units that are at Newport Barracks, my hometown, that are now being getting credit for being a Pickett's charge. And I think that's kind of cool.
And I always said, when I read your Newport Barracks book, and everybody should have it if they don't, I always say Brigadier General James Martin was my favorite character in that story.
Old One Wing, the hero of Chapultepec himself.
Nice. So there you go. Okay, so we have a bonus choice, a bonus selection that we thought it would be appropriate to end this segment with. And as you might imagine, it comes from none other than Dan Sickles,
the hero of Gettysburg,
writing to Batchelder. Now, this is in Volume 3, page 1962. Now, it is labeled August 10th, 1899, at least in the version of the book that I have. But it's got to be 1889 because A, Batchelder was dead by 1899, and B, it's filed with other 1889 stuff, including what I said before, correspondence related to the marking of the Confederate battle lines. And I am going to read in a little bit further here because it's Dan Sickles. And Eric, I just think it's so eloquently written by the former general. Sickles writes, "Complying with your request for my views, I have no hesitation in saying that I see no good reason why the lines of both armies at Gettysburg should not be marked. Everybody interested in the battlefield would like to know the positions held by both sides in the great conflict. I am sure the survivors of the Third Army Corps would be glad to see the positions held by Longstreet's infantry and artillery plainly marked. The battlefield of Gettysburg should belong to the government. It should be a military post garrisoned by artillery. With all the monuments prescribed, it would be an object lesson of patriotism for mankind through the centuries." And I can't think of any better way to end this segment than with Patriot, former Union General Dan Sickles, reminding us the meaning of patriotism for all of mankind throughout the centuries. I need to pause there and just collect my emotions.
I have my hand over my heart right now. God bless Dan Sickles,
exactly.
The hero of Gettysburg, Medal of Honor recipient, an all-around American hero.
Sickles haters, did you hear that closing? It would be an object lesson of patriotism for mankind through the centuries.
If you don't love Dan Sickles, you don't love America. So with that, as we move to the end of the episode, as we said, we had the most listener questions ever.
That's crazy.
For this, which I think shows how many people want to learn more about Batchelder, and we're very excited about this. So we hope that you are coming away from these two episodes with a better understanding of Batchelder and maybe a better sense of how to use his work, and if anything else, an appreciation of his work. So we do have a couple questions to kind of end on. The first question comes from Superfan Rich, who asked, who do you think was more influential in the memorialization and understanding of their respective battlefield? Batchelder at Gettysburg or Reed at Shiloh? Now, most people are going, what the heck, Shiloh? Isn't this an Eastern Theater show? Stuff happened out west. Well, David Reed served in the 12th Iowa at the Battle of Shiloh, and in some ways, he's very comparable to Batchelder. I would actually say Reed is more comparable to an Ezra Carman at Antietam. These are veterans of the war that serve and then come back to kind of document what they feel is a very important part of their service. I'm going to say Batchelder is more influential. One, Batchelder is influencing the way we view this battle from 1863 to his death. I mean, that's a long period of time to be influencing the way we view it, and I think the way we still view it to this day. Also, Reed and Carman do not really get into this until the 1890s.
Yeah.
So Batchelder's going to get access to individuals that you would have never gotten. I mean, you think about by the 1890s,
how many guys
who from Antietam and Shiloh would you like to talk to? Not taking anything away. I think every one of our national military parks has their form of a John Batchelder.
They do.
But I think what's interesting is we call them Shiloh's John Batchelder. Antietam's John Batchelder. Right. Chickamauga's John Batchelder.
Yeah, we don't call him Gettysburg's Ezra Carman.
No, and you know, and taking nothing away from those guys, but I think ultimately the longevity that Batchelder has, I think it's there.
Yeah, I would not disagree with any of that. And again, you know, you look at things like the high water mark, a significant portion of the battle's interpretation clearly specifically influenced by Batchelder. So I would agree with that as an example. Just a gratuitous mention here, as many of you, since we're talking about other battles, as many of you know, I'm a huge Little Bighorn enthusiast. The Battle of Little Bighorn, did you know they had their own John Batchelder? He was a railroad guy by the name of Walter Camp. He did the same thing. He went around, he interviewed participants, survivors, and frankly, he died before he ever wrote his ultimate version of it. So you're right, kind of every battlefield has their own John Batchelder, but there's only one John Batchelder.
And, you know, I'm proud to say I am the John Batchelder of Newport Barracks.
There you go.
So, you know, I'm happy to carry that title.
Is there a high watermark of Newport Barracks?
I can make one.
Well, why not?
Just like Batchelder.
Just like, right.
So our next question comes from Facebook. Superfan Chris writes, in your opinion, is Gettysburg viewed as such a monumental slash consequential battle today without Batchelder? The easy answer is Batchelder's influence is immense. I think because he, as one person characterized him, he's a cheerleader for Gettysburg. I think even without Batchelder, Gettysburg is going to be viewed as one of the more consequential moments of the war. It's the largest battle fought north of the Mason-Dixon line. It's a Union victory when they needed one desperately. And also, we have the Gettysburg Address here, which adds to that. Would Gettysburg overwhelm the other battles in terms of publications without Batchelder? Who knows? I mean, Batchelder certainly made Gettysburg be viewed as a focal point of the war.
Yeah.
But I think even without Batchelder, it's going to be remembered as a very important moment. I often say when most people think of a Civil War battle, one name comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
Gettysburg.
Yep. Yep.
Without Batchelder, I don't know. Maybe it might be a little more mixed bag, but I think Batchelder certainly does not hurt the effort to make Gettysburg one of the most consequential moments of the Civil War.
I think, well, first of all, it's a very provocative question, and you know, there's no easy answer, as we often like to say. I tend to think with the efforts of the veterans, which in many cases were independent of what Batchelder was doing, I tend to think without Batchelder, Gettysburg would still be, you know, what I always refer to as the Super Bowl of the Civil War kind of thing. But what I do think would be different, you know, without Batchelder, our interpretation in Gettysburg National Military Park would absolutely be different. You know, we touched on, you know, the emphasis on putting monuments where trying to meet a brigade line of battle. Again, that's not always perfect. But you go to other battlefields where monuments are all over the place and you just kind of go, huh, what? What the hell is this guy doing here? So there's that aspect to it. Again, the high water mark, as we talked about, is hugely influential. So I definitely think Gettysburg would still be remembered for what it is without Batchelder, but I just think it would be different. It would be laid out differently. It would be set up differently. It would be remembered and probably interpreted differently. Maybe Pickett's Charge would not be as famous without Batchelder, and I think that's probably a statement that I would feel more comfortable saying. Pickett's Charge and the whole July 3rd assault, hell, maybe we would be ending up our tours on Cult's Hill today. You know what I mean? So I think that is, in my opinion, at least Batchelder's more lasting legacy.
Yeah, and I think two great takeaways from your answer there. One, the veterans of the Army of the Potomac viewed Gettysburg right. as the most important. It's not Eric and Jim saying that. Right. Clearly the veterans viewed it as that. And also, I think you make a good point that, you know, we can argue that Pickett's Charge, the most famous military event in American history, and Batchelder is the guy that
right.
makes it that. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's a major influence there, but I think a great question in terms of how
question.
We view things.
Yep.
So our last question comes to us from Instagram, from Superfan Bryant, who asks, what would you ask Batchelder if you could?
Ooh.
And what do you think you could teach Batchelder about the battle?
So I'll answer the first part of that first. And again, great questions. Boy, what would I ask John Batchelder? Like, if I only had one question from the guy, I think, you know, given my own interest in Pickett's Charge, I think it would have to be, okay, Badger, buddy, you know, it's just me and you having a beer here at Getty's Gear on Cemetery Hill in the old Gettysburg Village. Tell me the truth. How did you come up with all this high watermark stuff? Do you really think it was the turning point? I don't know. I think I would just have to probe him on that. And, you know, was it all BS to help sell some painting or something? Or did you really think this was not only the high watermark of the battle, but you remember, it's supposed to be the high watermark of the rebellion. I think over beers with the Badger, I would probe him on that. But man, that's a tough question and a great one.
So the question I would ask Batchelder, for me, it would, I think, relate to the actions on McPherson's Ridge on July 1st in the afternoon. I spent years researching that, so I would love to run my thoughts by Batchelder, and I would love to also hear his interpretation of it, having interviewed veterans and commanders and such, because I think, you know, you learn from people that are really good at what they do, and Batchelder was really good at compiling information. I think, who knows, he may have had a conversation with somebody that would make me totally change my mind on something.
Yeah,
that,
right.
You know, so,
right.
So I think it would be like you would focus more on Pickett's Charge. I think for me, I would focus really what's going on in McPherson's Ridge on the afternoon of July 1st, 1863.
Sure.
So the second part, what could you teach John Batchelder?
Well, maybe I would teach the guy where Hancock was actually wounded, you know? Throwing a little heat on the Badger. You know, I don't know what I could teach Batchelder, but again, the thing that was struck with me when I was doing the deep dive was how he basically said, hey, I'm confused by the wheat field, which I thought was great. You know, this guy, the ultimate historian, wearing the championship belt of the United States government, basically says, I don't know what happened in the wheat field. It was a mess. So
what you're saying is you'd take Batchelder on a wheat field tour.
Exactly what I'm saying. Jim and the Badger do the wheat field. I think it would be a great tour. How about you?
You know, my simple answer, I could teach John Batchelder how to give a 2-hour car tour.
Woo! Yeah.
Or in times of COVID,
yes,
a 3-hour socially distanced point to point COVID tour.
And would the Badger be in a car or would he be in his carriage?
You know, I don't know. Maybe we'll give him a Segway or a Getty Ped. I mean, could you see Batchelder just zipping around in one of those things?
On a Segway with his flowing white whiskers?
Put him on a Segway or a Getty pet. No, I think what I would, and I kind of joke, I could show him a two-hour tour. What I think would be fascinating is Batchelder viewing this battlefield that he is so connected to in 2020.
Agree.
To see what it looks like.
Yeah,
and how we're talking about it, and to see how his work is still here today. So, yeah, I gave kind of a stupid answer, but I think it would be a fascinating experience to take him around to show him the modern interpretation of the battle.
I was thinking kind of along the same lines too. Like, imagine, like, you know, the reality is the basic art tour, I never go to East Cemetery Hill. Imagine him saying, oh my God, Jim, you don't go to East Cemetery. That was the highlight of the battle.
What about the bullet scar trees on Culp's Hill?
Exactly. Yeah. So, you're right. It would be fascinating if he could come back and join us. You know, what would he say about the way we interpret the battle today?
And also, when it's all said and done, he probably says, hey, can I buy an ad on your show? Because you're up to 65 nations. You're up to 50 states. Imagine the word I could get out about my tour book and my maps. You are my guy.
In my time, I had to, you know, get into a hot air balloon to reach 65 countries.
I had to hire 999 guys.
Yeah.
So, you know, just saying. No, I think it would be fascinating to see that. And one of the things that's intrigued me is how the way we tour the battlefield has changed. What do we emphasize? What we don't emphasize?
Yeah.
And because those are things that I think about a lot. 20 years from now, will I be doing roughly the same two-hour tour that I'm doing now? I don't know. I hope not.
I'll tell you what.
I hope it's adapted.
I'll tell you what, I'm almost at 20 years. 20 years later, a lot of stuff that I thought was important 20 years ago, I don't really cover it as much. So I think that's absolutely right. And again, for any newer guide colleagues who are listening out there, I can guarantee you in 20 years, you will be doing a lot of different stuff that you're not doing today. And a lot of it comes into the repertoire subtly. You don't even realize you're doing it, but you pick up an anecdote or, you know, when you start out, the exact troop position and where exactly everybody stood, all of that is so important. And over time, you kind of realize it's really just more important, I think, to kind of capture the spirit of Gettysburg and tell the stories of the men who fought there. So, yeah, in the tradition of John Batchelder, I can guarantee pretty much anybody who is interpreting today, 20 years from tonight, will have a maybe not a drastically different tour, but a pretty radically different one. I know mine is different.
And I would hope that Batchelder would be very proud of the job that we do as licensed battlefield guides in terms of the rigorous process we have to go through to do what we do and to keep the story alive, that ultimately his, I think, motivation in the end is to try to get the story right.
Yep.
To the best of his ability. I think that's ultimately my motivation as a guide. It's your motivation. I think if that's not any other guide's motivation, you probably need to find another line of work.
That's right.
If your job's not to tell the story as accurately as you can and to connect people to it. So I think Batchelder will be very proud of us, especially that just only a few years after his death, the government is continuing this. I think he'd be very proud of that. And hopefully he would, you know, give us some kudos for what we're doing.
And I hope that he would be proud of the fact that we have now done 2 Battle of Gettysburg podcasts on his life and times. But remember, Jim and Eric are not speaking on behalf of any group other than Jim and Eric.
Nope. Weird.
In our love and admiration of John the Badger Batchelder.
And Dan Sickles. So I think with that, that kind of puts a bow on the episode. So a few more things before we go. We want to remind you where you can find us on social media. You can find us on Facebook at the Battle of Gettysburg Podcast, on Twitter at Gettysburg Pod, on Instagram at the Battle of Gettysburg Podcast. Also, you know, like us, share us, follow us. Also, folks, those reviews matter. So if you've given one, thank you. If you're still thinking about it, please, if you can get just a few moments, we greatly appreciate it. So before we go, Jim, tell the folks about our kind hosts and sponsors this week.
Oh, yeah. Yes, once again, we have come to you live from Getty's Gear, located at 777 Baltimore Street in the old Gettysburg Village, across from the Tour Center on Cemetery Hill. Now, if you need to contact them, their number is 717-334-3747. or you can email them at info@gettysgear.com. Again, whether by the time this airs, you're still doing your holiday shopping or you're shopping post-Christmas, you know, for all the stuff you wanted but didn't get. Remember, they've got all kinds of stuff that is, you know, affiliated with Gettysburg. Cigars, coffee, apparel, home decor, stuff for the men, stuff for the ladies, stuff for that special dog in your life. Gettysgear does it with a sense of style. And I will close my part of tonight's show by reminding you, the listener, that's the style.
So as we close out part two of John Batchelder, we start looking ahead to the next episode. And this is one that I think Jim is going to be very happy about.
I'm giddy with excitement.
You know, this is one that why we have waited to season three, I don't know. But here we are. We are going to do most likely a two-part look. Well, you know, I'm not going to say most likely. It will be a
We're
two-part
declaring it?
Look
okay.
at the fighting on the afternoon of July 3rd, 1863, what we generally know as East Cavalry Field. We've got horses. We've got dashing cavalrymen. We've got Wade Hampton, and we've got George Armstrong Custer.
And not coincidentally, we are recording this today on George Armstrong Custer's birthday. Needless to say, George Custer has a little bit of a public image perception problem with the American public today. We will try to put Custer in the proper context of where he fits, if not during the Civil War, at least on July 3rd at the Battle of Gettysburg. So hopefully you'll tune in for that one. I don't know about you, Eric, but I'm super excited to be doing it. And season three is just shaping up to be our best one yet.
So I think, you know, we still haven't fully figured out how exactly we're going to do East Cavalry Field. Is it going to be Custer at Gettysburg, or is it going to be the fighting out there? We're not really sure, but, you know, we've got some time to figure that out. And certainly your listener questions will help us in that direction as well. So once again, we want to thank you for listening, and this has been the Battle of Gettysburg podcast.
Take care, everyone.